In 2010, three Iowa Supreme Court justices lost their election for retention. This defeat sparked major changes, which increased transparency and public outreach at the state's highest court. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. In for Ben Kiefer, I'm Sarah Bowden. Today, we look at the Iowa Supreme Court's new era of transparency with Todd Pettis from the University of Iowa College of Law. Also, Mustafa Bayoumi, award-winning author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America, discusses post-9/11 life for Muslims in the U.S. That's coming up right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Sarah Bowden, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. When Chief Justice Marsha Ternus and Justices David Baker and Michael Streit lost their election for retention on the Iowa Supreme Court in 2010, it was the first time since the court adopted the retention system in 1962 that a justice was not retained. Also, in the 70 years since California became the first state to adopt the retention system, only 8 Supreme Court justices nationwide have lost a retention election. While the 3 justices did very little to defend their spots on the bench, a major campaign for their removal was led by conservative activist Bob Vanderplaats, who was upset over the court's unanimous vote that legalized same-sex marriage in the state 19 months earlier. As a result of the 2010 election, the Iowa Supreme Court made a number of changes that increased the court's transparency and public outreach. Joining me now is Todd Pettis, Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. He recently published a paper in the Journal of Appellate Practice and Process, which examines the 2010 retention election and its aftermath. Todd, welcome to River to River.
Thanks very much.
So the justices only got 45% of the vote. They lost the retention election. How did that affect the court?
It was a kind of a wake-up call. Now, wake up to what was the question, but it was the kind of event that you don't just kind of blink and look past and say, oh, well, that happened then. It's never going to happen again. You really have to take a look at yourself as an institution and ask, are there things that we should be doing that we didn't do before that if we had been doing before, maybe the outcome here would have been different? Or to put it more in a more forward-looking way, are there things that we should be doing so that the next time one of us stands for retention, we're likely to be happier with the outcome? Or to put it even in a different way, setting aside retention elections altogether, are there things, are there ways we should be doing business? Are there things that we should be doing that are really in the best interest not only of ourselves but of the people of Iowa? Are there ways we could do our job better? And it certainly, I think, prompted that round of self-reflection and discussion within the court.
So there was self-reflection and discussion on the court. What conclusion did the remaining justices come to, the 4 remaining justices?
Well, the following month, this would have been January 2011, newly elected Chief Justice Katie, and I mean, when I say newly elected, I don't mean newly elected by the people of Iowa. I mean that the justices on the Iowa Supreme Court themselves decide who's going to be Chief Justice. And with Chief Justice Marsha Ternus having been removed, they needed a new Chief Justice. And so they chose Mark Katie. He gave his State of the Judiciary speech in Des Moines to the legislature in January of that year. In that speech, among other important things, he said, and his line was something along the lines of, we need to get to know one another better. And we, the court, and you, the Iowa legislature, and you, the larger people of Iowa, we need to get to know one another better. And it set in motion a number of changes that they made, a couple at least, that are important and that are lasting to this day, different ways of doing business.
How would you gauge the Iowa Supreme Court transparency before the 2010 retention election and today?
I would say before the 2010 retention election, Iowa was very much like most other states and like the federal judiciary, which is they do their business largely behind closed doors. Not, and I don't mean that in kind of a pejorative sense. I just mean it in the traditional sense that judges, when they talk with one another about how to decide a particular case, they're not Congress. They don't hold public hearings and talk to one another with microphones in front of them. They have oral arguments, and we hear from the judges then when the parties are presenting their arguments to the court. But the judges then go back to their offices and they think, and they talk to one another. So how are we going to decide this case? And how are we going to vote? And then there's a long kind of quiet period where the public hears nothing as they work on their opinion. The public at that point typically has no idea what the outcome is going to be. And that's the way courts historically have done business. It's still true that when the court hears cases now, they go back, they talk amongst themselves privately about how they're going to decide the case. They still vote privately. There's still this long quiet period leading up to the ultimate announcement of the decision. But they've made changes in other ways, and I'll just give you an example or two. In that State of the Judiciary speech, Chief Justice Kady said, we're going to start holding oral arguments in places outside our usual courtroom. And so through 2011, 2012, and even now, they hold our oral arguments in places like high school gymnasiums in small towns, places that can seat a lot of people. They come in, they set up some chairs and some tables for the justices to sit, and then people come in and fill the bleachers and watch, and they sometimes draw hundreds of people to see these things. And so it's people who ordinarily would not make the trip to Des Moines to find out, you know, so how am I going to get to Des Moines? What time exactly do I need to be there? Where am I going to park? All those things. Instead, they can go to their local high school or junior high and get a sense of how courts work. You know, what these justices look like, what their voices sound like, the kinds of questions that they ask, seeing attorneys in action. So seeing some things that for a great many of them, they've never seen in person. So that's one of the changes the court has made.
To me, that's kind of incredible going to a gym in Bettendorf and watching the state Supreme Court justices.
Yeah, it is a wonderful thing. And, you know, we started, you said, so how transparent is this court? You know, I haven't looked to see how many other state Supreme Courts tour their states in this way, but I'm sure it's a quite a small number. And the hope is great understanding of the court and the kinds of questions and the kinds of arguments that are being made and considered that are going to lead to an ultimate outcome. In other words, the justices are not deciding these cases just by saying, well, you know, what's my own personal preference here, and so that's how I'm going to vote. But you see the process that ultimately is going to culminate in a decision in that particular case.
So aside from touring around the state, justices have also been making more media appearances, which prior to 2010, they weren't doing, correct?
Well, yeah, and you know, they would, I'm sure, do the occasional media appearance, but I don't think that it was, you know, kind of a self-consciously chosen important thing for them to be sure that they're doing on a pretty regular basis. And I'm not party to their discussions, so I don't know the specifics. But if you look at how 2011 and 2012 played out, Chief Justice Mark Kady, just a couple days after he gave his State of the Judiciary speech, he was in a television studio taping a show for Iowa Public TV. And that continued. Reporters' access, the public's access, you know, when the justices go to these different towns to hold these oral arguments, they don't just helicopter in, so to speak, and then take off right away. They often coordinate other speaking engagements where they'll go and they'll talk to public school children, or, you know, they'll go to a local church or somewhere else that can easily seat a number of people, and they'll field questions. We certainly have seen more of that in the last couple of years than we did prior to 2010. And I think many of us feel, and I suspect the members of the court feel, though they could speak for themselves, that this is all to the good.
And we did reach out to the Supreme Court. They're unable to join us today. Their session did start on the 8th, so they're pretty busy right now. When Justice Kennedy made his State of the Judiciary address 2 months after the retention vote in 2011, he waved to retention supporters who were in the observation gallery at the Capitol.
Well, one of the things, and this was captured in a photograph that the Des Moines Register put on the front page, what had happened, as I understand it, is at that time, so this is the election has happened, three members have been removed, but of course that leaves four more members of the court who had participated in Varnum, that is the same-sex marriage ruling, and there was some talk in some quarters in the legislature of trying to pursue impeachment, mm-hmm. that is to remove the remaining justices. And there were a few legislators who were leading that charge. There were many opponents of the charge, including, for starters, the governor and some of the Republican leaders in the state legislature. So there were many opponents, but there were some proponents. And so one of the organizations that favored keeping these justices on the bench had made an effort, as I understand it, to help fill the gallery, that is the viewing area in the state legislature, with supporters of the justices.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a pause or applause or some other evident support coming from this section. And so I think it was either before or after. I think it was after his remarks as he was leaving the room. Chief Justice Kennedy waved in their direction, apparently.
This was seen as political by some people.
Some people thought that it was political. I think, it was kind of the wave, the notion of kind of, it wasn't my view, so I may not be the best person to explain what the thought process was, but I can understand it in this sense. In Chief Justice Kennedy's comments, he had taken the time to defend the Varnum ruling, and I think that some legislators thought that taking this public defense of Varnum coupled with an appearance where there are supporters and he would wave to them for some people, I think not many, but for some, that really rubbed them the wrong way. And if you are an opponent of Varnum, you are kind of a captive audience. You're sitting there quietly as this person says things that you strongly disagree with, and that didn't sit right with some.
To me, it displays emotion or a lack of stoicism that I would normally associate with the justice. Which, to me, that's the surprising thing, is that it's a very human moment.
The image to compare it with, for those who watch the presidential State of the Union speech, we see some members, it used to be all, and now it's not quite all, some choose not to come anymore, but some members of the United States Supreme Court come, and they get very good seating up near the front. They come dressed in their robes, and they are, you use the word stoic, I think, while the room around them might erupt in applause as Republicans or Democrats take turns standing up and applauding or booing, the justices usually sit there with their hands in their laps and betraying nothing, usually, with their facial expressions. And so perhaps it's with the background of that understanding that some would take a gesture like a wave and say, this is something new.
It seems that the justices are also trying to appear more human to the public. For example, there was an open house on Labor Day in 2011 where the justices gave tours of the courtroom and their chambers, and members of the public were allowed to sit on the justices' chairs. To me, this is it's kind of incredible. I can't imagine this ever happening anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is something kind of interesting when you meet people, and I'm sure many listeners have had this experience. There may be someone famous or semi-famous whose name you know, and you form an impression of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you meet them in person, and suddenly that pre-constructed image that you had of them falls away. We also have the opposite, where we'll see someone whom we think we like a lot and have a lot of respect for just from what we understand of either their media image or photographs and so forth. And then we meet them, or we hear about someone who met them, and they're very rude, or that kind of challenges our image. But these in-person encounters do flesh out or three-dimensionalize our understanding of people. And you're more likely to get to that kind of perception, I think, if you've had encounters like the one you described, where you kind of go in, you get to meet them, you get to sit in the chairs where they sit and see what the room looks like from that elevated bench. You can trade a few jokes, talk about some towns or family members or people you share in common. You know, I think that that does promote this understanding between the court and the people of Iowa.
At the same time, though, is it wise to emphasize one's humanity? Because they're not like us. They're making decisions for all of us.
You know, they are very much people like us. It's just that when they do what they do, their decisions have consequences that our decisions don't. And so emphasizing their humanity, coming to know them as three-dimensional people with personalities and what their laugh sounds like and what their handshake feels like and how tall are they, how short are they, how warm do they seem or not when you meet them, all those kinds of things that go into how you, you know, form an impression of someone. I think that they are right to err in that direction. Again, just to draw some comparisons to the federal Supreme Court, Justice Scalia, a strong conservative on the U.S. Supreme Court, and Justice Ginsburg, a strong liberal on the court, they are very dear friends. They have traveled together. They have gone, I think, to the opera together. And when we hear that, I think I recall reading that Justice Scalia and Justice Sotomayor, a new Obama appointee to the court, went hunting together in the Rocky Mountain states this last summer, and there were some press reports about whether they got a deer and some jokes and so forth. But I think most people, when they hear that kind of thing, they like it. There's something reassuring about it, knowing that even these people like Justices Scalia and Ginsburg, who so strongly disagree with one another often on the court and come at legal questions from different sides, nevertheless, having had those disagreements and having seen each other close up, are really fond of each other and like traveling together and laugh together, I think those are good things. It breaks down the notion that it's all about ideology, it's all about choosing a side and waging war on behalf of your side. Courts are unique institutions where they can have passionate disagreements and where tempers can run high and sharp words can be exchanged, but they are seeing each other up close on a daily basis as they make these decisions, and they still respect each other and they still see one another as people who operate in good faith. I think the more that that internal kind of understanding of one another within a court can be conveyed to the public, I think the better off we are in understanding who our courts are. And so when the Iowa Supreme Court opens its doors or travels the state and wants to meet people, and you can form these little impressions of how they seem with one another and how they seem to you and how cordial or friendly they are, I really think that that helps.
Going off your point about ideology, Justice Katie said that the court needed to do a better job at explaining to the public that their decisions were steeped in legal reasoning and not ideology. Do you think that the court is sensitive to the fact that they may not always appear to have their decisions steeped in legal reasoning?
Well, let's compare them for a second to just elected officials. President Obama is, you know, weighing some difficult decisions about Syria, or we can decide whether we want to keep or modify or leave unchanged the federal health care law. We have all these political debates about things, and we have many, many, sometimes more than we would like, opportunities to hear these elected officials address the media, get behind a microphone in front of a camera, and talk about what their thought process is. And then when they make their decision, they come and explain it, and there's a lot of follow-up, and they can come back to the press the next day and talk about it. Courts are very different. By and large, when they make their decisions, their deliberation process is quiet as they work on writing their opinions, and then they do produce a written document that the great majority of people will never read. And so when people are forming impressions of the court, it's often not the words of the court itself or the words of the justices themselves that are forming opinions. It's instead, how is a reporter characterizing this opinion or summarizing just who won and who lost? And then we form, not having read the opinion, you might form a reaction to that outcome. Say, oh, well, this person won or that person lost. How can it be? And it's very tempting to kind of rush and say, well, it's got to be ideology or it's got to be preference or it's got to be bias or something illegitimate. And so from the court's perspective, I would expect that to be kind of frustrating. Sometimes you put a lot of thought, you write this document, and people people never read it.
We saw that perhaps come into play this last session with Nelson v. Knight, where a woman was fired because the man she worked for, a dentist, found her attractive, and the dentist's wife said, "You need to fire her." And they went to court because she said this was sexual discrimination, and the court said it wasn't. And then the court reissued an opinion because, perhaps like what you were saying, news media grabbed onto a catchy headline and perhaps altered what the justices had actually written in their opinion.
Yeah, and you know, you say perhaps, and then we do have to say perhaps because they haven't explained why they took the time to reconsider this case and then issue a new set of opinions. But it appears to be just as you've described. Opinion number one, or set of opinions number one, comes out. The court says, here's what we understand this case to be. Here are the legal issues. Here are how we resolve them. It makes national news. It does come under some criticism. And the court then announces that they're going to take this case under reconsideration. And they come back and they issue another decision. They don't change their mind. The same people, the same winner, same loser, that's unchanged. The key rationales of the court remained unchanged. But what we did get was a new opinion written by Chief Justice Katie, going to some length to try to explain why the court was doing what it was doing and why it wasn't doing something else, and where responsibility might lie if you, as the people of Iowa, see this and you don't like this. Well, here's why we did it, and here's what you would need to do in order to change the law to produce a different outcome. You know, whether we would have seen that kind of reissued opinion before 2010, I don't know, but it's pretty easy, I think, to draw some connections and say this is a court that is for which it's very important to be understood. That doesn't mean they're trying to, that they're campaigning for your vote, or that they even necessarily want you to agree with them. They just want you to understand what they're saying and why they're saying it.
Now, it's very unique to reissue an opinion, correct?
It's quite uncommon, yes.
Do you think we could see more of that in the future?
I would not expect to see a lot of it. And I think it's probably important for the court not to do it often, because if they frequently issued an opinion, and then there's a period of public response, and then they come back with some additional opinions by way of explaining, I think that that would not serve the court's interests well. But as in this case, and perhaps in a few others from time to time, if the justices see a public discussion going on about a case and the justices think, you know, the people who are talking about the case, they don't understand what we did or why we did it, I think that they may look for opportunities to explain further. And now that might take the form of a reissued opinion. Again, I think that's going to be rare and probably should be quite rare. It could be in media appearances. It could be in a Q&A session after one of these oral arguments when they do their little road show and, you know, doing oral arguments in different places. In a variety of ways, I think that they are quite sensitive to the need to be understood by the public.
Thank you so much, Todd, for being here.
Thanks very much.
Todd Pettis is the Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Coming up, what it's like to be Muslim in post-9/11 America. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bowden, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. With the recent anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks and this year's Boston Marathon bombing, American Muslims may again feel that they are under suspicion. Mustafa Bayoumi is giving a lecture on Islamophobia, the challenges of being Muslim in America, at Iowa State University this Wednesday. Bayoumi is author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem, Being Young and Arab in America. He teaches English at Brooklyn College, City University of New York. Mustafa, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You write that life for Arabs in the U.S. changed on September 11, 2001. How would you describe American life for Muslims pre-9/11?
Well, I think most Americans had very little you know, recognition of their Arab or Muslim neighbors. I think when most Americans thought about Arabs or Muslims, they tended to think of things happening overseas. So in a way, we were, in some senses, invisible, I guess you could say. And then I think what happened after 9/11 is immediately we became hyper-visible. It's almost like moving from the shadows into the glare of a spotlight, you could say. And it's a strange experience to suddenly, you know, exist where everybody has an opinion about you, even though they don't know that much about you per se.
And you say that hate crimes against Arabs and Muslims in America spiked by, am I getting this number right, 1,700%?
Yeah, that's true for the immediate aftermath of the terrorist attacks of 2001. There was a lot of vigilante violence that, you know, the community really had to deal with in a really scary moment.
And on Wednesday, you're giving a lecture on Islamophobia. How do you define Islamophobia?
I use the term, but I'm not a big fan of it, actually. I use the term because most people use it and it has a kind of recognition, I think, in the general culture. But a phobia is essentially a fear. And I don't think that necessarily it's a fear of Muslims or a fear of Islam that drives a lot of the animosity. I think there's a kind of anti-Muslim sentiment, rather. It's probably more akin to a kind of anti-Semitism than it is to a kind of fear. I mean, homophobia, I guess, would be the corollary for Islamophobia. And it seems to me that what's going on is that there's a sensibility out there among certain segments of the population that just sees Islam as being somehow the opposite of a kind of liberal American democratic project. And I don't think that that's true. I think that there's a lot of, you know, Islamic civilization is a long-standing, rich civilization that has all kinds of complex corners to it. And I think when most people are talking about Islam these days, unfortunately, they don't really know very much of the history. And instead, what they rely upon are very simplistic notions of us versus them, of friend versus enemy, and that creates a kind of animosity, and it also creates a very torn subjectivity with Muslim Americans who seem like they are constantly having to prove their American credentials, even though they are American themselves.
Prominent members of the American Muslim community came out and condemned the 9/11 attacks. Yet, Islamophobia persists. What do you think happens? Where does the messaging stray?
Well, you know, for one thing, it really takes two sides to have a conversation. One side speaks and the other side listens. And, you know, I'm afraid to say that I feel like there's a lot of not listening going on from, much of the American general public, or really a lot of it comes out of news media that portray this idea over and over again that Muslim Americans don't condemn the 9/11 attacks or terrorism generally, when, in fact, whenever there's a terrorist attack, it's almost universally condemned immediately, and it's easy to find that out. I think a lot of it actually stems from the fact that a lot of Americans who are not Muslim don't actually even know anybody who is a Muslim American. There was a poll that was taken, I think, back in 2010 by Time Magazine, or commissioned by Time Magazine, that found that 62% of the American public, so almost two-thirds of the American public, had never even met a Muslim. And I think that's an astonishing number, because what it means is that at least two-thirds of the American public are really getting their primary data, their primary source material to form their opinions around Islam and Muslims, essentially from media, from news media, from popular culture, from television shows, from movies. And those representations tend to be very cardboardy, very narrow, very drawn with a great deal of hostility and not a great deal of complexity.
Other countries like France and the UK also grapple with the way their Muslim community is treated and issues with integration and acceptance. Is there a difference between the Islamophobia in the UK and France versus the United States?
Yes, I think that actually there is. And I think in my work, one of the most important things is to try to make those differences more clear, even though some of the repercussions might look the same. But I think that the differences essentially are historical. You know, both France and England have large Muslim populations that essentially derive out of the colonial experiences of those countries. So England had a large colonial presence in the Asian subcontinent, you know, so a lot of Indian and Pakistanis and Bangladeshis are there. And that's true in France, too, with a lot of North Africans. And what that has also meant is that they occupy largely very poor and working class segments of those populations. And that's not the case in the United States. Most Muslim Americans are actually middle class, and they don't come with the same kind of colonial baggage that you find in Europe. And so I think that those European attitudes have a longer history and a longer depth, and in some ways a longer, you know, problem, a longer view of the same, of a similar problem. So I do think it's very important to try to look at the specificities of these different places to see how they express themselves, because sometimes what's, you know, the animosity could also be very related to issues around class, social class, and getting ahead and these sorts of things, rather than refracted only through one's religion.
Regarding this animosity, are there lessons that we can learn from how France or England has dealt with this animosity versus the U.S.?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that there's a long, both France and England also still have a long way to go. I think that really what's required essentially is a lot more conversation between different groups of people, and a lot less stereotyping, a lot less seeing each other as simply a member of a religious community and not as a member of society. When we talk about members of society with a lot of other groups, I think we tend to think about them in much more complex fashion. We tend to think about their social standing, their immigration history, their family structure, you know, their core values and these sorts of things. But when we talk about Muslims, we tend to only talk about verses from the Quran, from one book, and I think that tends to simplify the way that people talk about Muslims, and I think that that's actually true in Europe as well as it is in the United States.
Mm-hmm. You yourself are Arab. Have you experienced animosity or prejudice in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm both Arab and Muslim, so I suppose you could call it a double whammy in ways, but. You know, I mean, the other side of it too, of course, is that I'm a somewhat public figure around this issue too. So I receive hate mail and things like that. That's not uncommon. I get routinely randomly checked at airports. Randomly is in quotation marks. So these sorts of things are you know, things that I have to deal with. But I don't think that they're of the magnitude that a lot of other people have also had to deal with. And so it's really, you know, the kinds of stories that I'm trying to tell in my book and that I'm trying to talk about generally are not really about me per se, but they're really about what's happening both to the Arab and Muslim communities in the United States, but also to the culture of the United States generally.
You write that many young Arabs and Muslims dream of going to Dubai, leaving the country and starting a new life somewhere else. Why is this such a common dream? Why Dubai?
Well, that was especially the case for one of the young men that I wrote about in my book. In the book, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem, I write about seven different young people, all from Brooklyn, New York, all Arab Americans from Brooklyn, New York, and the different ways that post 9/11 life has impacted their lives. And one of the young men that I write about, I was hanging out with him and his friends for quite a while, and a lot of them were the sons of the corner stores. You know, in New York City, a lot of the corner stores are run by Arab Americans. And so it's a kind of key element of Arab American life. And so I was hanging out with them and getting a sense of what they want from life. And they were seeing, a lot of them were seeing their opportunities. They were afraid that their opportunities for employment were really going to narrow because there was going to be, you know, advances or increases in employment discrimination in the country. Meanwhile, there's a sense that places in the Emirates, like Dubai and Abu Dhabi, have rapidly expanding economies, and because they have Arabic language and they have a large Muslim populations, and in fact a kind of core Muslim ethos to them, that the young men often felt that they may feel themselves more at home there than even in the United States, where they were born and had been raised.
That's incredibly disheartening.
It is, actually. I found it disheartening to some degree when I was writing my chapter, because the young man I was writing about, his name's Akram, he's like a supremely talented individual. He's really funny. He's really super smart. He's a really terrific guy. And in fact, you know, when I finished the book, he was still here in Brooklyn. But by the time that the book has been, now it's been out for a few years, he actually has moved to the United Arab Emirates, and he's become a successful teacher there and is moving up the ranks of the education establishment there. And so I see that actually as a bit of a loss for the United States.
Your book is titled, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem Being Young and Arab in America?, which references a line in the W.E.B. Du Bois poem, The Souls of Black Folk. Do you draw similarities between Muslims and Arabs today and the Jim Crow South?
I don't try to draw them directly. I don't think that one has to say that the African-American experience or the Arab-American experience is exactly the same as the African-American experience to make a useful comparison. Obviously, the experiences are different, and there is no legitimate comparison to be drawn, because the experiences of hundreds of years of slavery and Jim Crow are horrendous and constitutional to they defined in many ways the essence of the United States. But I do think, though, that a lot of minority groups and movements seeking civil rights equality in the United States have often drawn on the civil rights struggle in the United States and its history to argue that there's a way in which people are made to be an other. There's a way in which racialization happens over and over again in American history. And so I think it's useful to try to think about the ways in which that does happen. And so my comparison is meant, in a sense, to try to draw that analogy rather than to say that they're equal.
And you also write that Arabs and Muslims are the new problem in our society. How do you define problem in this sense?
There's a line, I'm going to paraphrase it, I don't remember it exactly, by
Between me and the other world, there is ever an unasked question, unasked by some feelings of delicacy, by others through the difficulty of rightly phrasing it. All nevertheless flutter around it. How does it feel to be a problem?
Yeah, I mean, that's Du Bois talking and writing in his book, and, I in fact stole the title of my book right from him. But the line that I was thinking of explicitly was one from James Baldwin, actually later on, who writes something to the effect that to be an African American, and here I'm paraphrasing, he writes something around the idea that to be an African American means that you're constantly subject to statistics, to social scientists coming in and studying you, to being like the topic of news conversations, to being at the essence of what a whole kind of apparatus is sets up to understand you and where you fit, and that doesn't happen to a lot of other ethnic groups, and it certainly didn't happen to the Arab or Muslim communities prior to 9/11. So I think one way of defining the problem, the idea of being a problem, is the fact that it seems to me that after 9/11, that almost everybody in the country will hold an opinion about what it means to be Muslim or Arab when they haven't even met you before.
You said earlier that the way that we can move forward from this tragic period of our history is to talk to each other more, but that can be so awkward. How do you start the conversation?
That's a really good question. I think that the one way that we really have to start the conversation is to treat each other as complex individuals and not merely as representatives of our of certain types of political or religious positions. I live as an Arab and Muslim American. I'm in constant contact with other Arab and Muslim Americans. I can tell you that the Arab and Muslim American communities are themselves very diverse and complex and rich, and they have a lot of different angles to them. And that side of it is, I think, almost never really represented in the mainstream. And so if we only are talking to each other as, well, what does the Muslim think, or what does the Christian think, or what does the Jewish person think, then I feel like somehow we end up reinscribing our differences from each other. It really seems very important to me that we approach each other as complex individuals, as like whole human beings, and to try to understand the hopes and the dreams and the aspirations that we all have, because when we do that, we'll find that we're really not that different from each other.
do you in your personal life have a diverse group of friends?
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have friends from, I think maybe it's one of the advantages of living in New York City, but I have friends really from all over the world and of all different faiths and non-faiths. I have many atheist friends as well.
Because I think for people, for example, parts of Iowa aren't very diverse, and I think that people would like to learn more about other cultures and other religions, but it's hard. It's hard to build those personal connections. Do you have any advice for us?
I think that's an incredibly important question, and it gets back to that statistic that I was citing earlier, how around two-thirds of the American public does not have that kind of contact with Muslim Americans. And I think that that's a place where the arts and media can play a huge role, you know. And I think that we really need to understand and to see a lot more from Muslim Americans in their own artistic production, in their own production of their own news, in the way that they represent themselves and their communities. I think, unfortunately, for a long time, they're always represented, but they very rarely get to represent themselves to the general public. And in part, it's also, I have to say, I think it's a failure of the American Muslim community over generations. The American Muslim community, a large segment of it, probably around two-thirds of it, is generally an immigrant-based community. So they're either immigrants or children of immigrants or the children of immigrants. And many people who come here from parts of the Muslim world or parts of the so-called third world, they come here favoring very much the sciences and business and not really putting a lot of emphasis in the humanities, in journalism, in art. And I think that that's something that I do see changing within the Muslim community, and I think that we have to not just embrace that, but we have to expand those efforts as well.
Aside from your book, How Does It Feel to Be a Muslim, which was published by Penguin in 2009, what are some other movies or books that people who are curious about what it's like to be Arab or Muslim, especially Arab or Muslim in America, might check out?
Well, there's a great book called A Map of Home, which is a novel by another young ish Arab and Muslim, youngish like me, Arab and Muslim writer. Her name is Randa Jarrar, J-A-R-R-A-R. It's very funny and a kind of wild ride about growing up in the Middle East, in Kuwait and in Texas. There's another very good book called The Girl in the Tangerine Scarf by Mohcha Kahf, K-A-H-F, and she has written that's a novel also about a pre-9/11 period, but really it really gives a really wonderful sense about what it means to grow up as a Muslim in the United States and to be connected to Syria. In her situation, she's a Syrian American writer, and so she's very interested in questions of faith and questions of devotion and questions of geography. And I think it's a really terrific novel.
So, Mustafa, you published your book in 2008. Have things gotten better?
Well, no, unfortunately, you know, it seems that things have gotten actually worse, and I'm not just basing that on my opinion, but in fact also on polling data, which has seen a rise in hostility. You know, there are several national polls that will ask this kind of question, and they now come around, they hover around the 50% mark, around 50% of Americans will say that they have hostile feelings towards Islam and Muslims, and that number was lower before. And you also get these movements like the anti-Ground Zero mosque movement. You have a kind of populist anger often towards Muslims. You have these movements in state legislatures that are saying that they want to stop Sharia law from taking over the country, which is, in my mind, a ludicrous proposition, and yet it seems to have political traction for some reason. And then you also have the advances of a sort of national security state apparatus directed, you know, squarely at the Muslim American community.
Mustafa Bayoumi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Mustafa Bayoumi will be at Iowa State University this Wednesday to discuss post-9/11 Muslim life in America. He is the author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Ben Stanton. Technical support by Dennis Reese. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Ben Kiefer will be back tomorrow. I'm Sarah Bowden. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.